And they sort of pepper potted, sort of one foot in the ground, so they're giving us cover as we're moving in to darkness. And we got there, we tipped up in downtown in Basel, right next to the Châtel Arab River. And then they knew we were coming, obviously. There was it attracts a lot of attention, you know. And as I remember getting there and this RPG flying straight over our heads, we're like, well, fucking hell, lads, this is real. Game faces on, let's go.
Well, it's official. As we all slowly claw our way back out of the pit that's been COVID, we're finally back with the next episode of the No Excuse podcast. And in today's episode, it'll be slightly different as we introduce to you a new series of videos that we're calling Life in Focus. In these videos, our guests will sit front and centre and relay their experiences and their stories in their own words.
Have you ever visited hell? That nauseating hole that tries to swallow you up. A hell whose smells and sounds instantly transport you back. A hell that plays over and over relentlessly in your mind. A hell that makes you question your reason for living. So a little bit about me. I grew up in a small town in Northern Ireland called Antrim. It's just north of Belfast, about 20 miles north. It was just me and my mum that grew up there. She was married previously, but my biological father left when I was a few weeks old, so I don't know him. Probably a good job I don't know him, because he was quite abusive, I heard from my mum. So Not really a good start for her, I suppose, being pregnant with me. So we grew up, it was a small sort of terrace houses, loads of them, pebble dashed houses. Every other one was boarded up because the area was ran by sort of a paramilitary sort of group. And if you weren't welcome, you got burnt out. And that violence was very much enforced quite early on in my life, which, talking about it now and having my own children seems different, but to anyone listening back home in Northern Ireland and myself, it was just the norm. It's just how we rolled. A couple of events when I was young, you know, I witnessed numerous punishment beatings, and also there was a guy who got kneecapped. Kneecapping is quite a sort of infamous punishment in Northern Ireland, and it means if you've fucked up, you're going to get punished, and it can be a batten to the knees, or in this occasion, it was a pistol through the back of the kneecap, and it explodes the front of the kneecap out. And I was about 8 years old, and we heard the bang, and we were straight over to see what it was, and this guy was lying in the garden. Initially, the police were turning up, and we were trying to get this information, like, what's going on? Really interested. Yeah, it was just, that's just where it was, you know, the sort of the streets around there sort of bathed in blood of history, and you could sort of tell stories on that alone. So until I was about 8 years old, I spent a lot of time in my nan and granda's house, a hell of a lot of time, and my two uncles, as they were helping my mum raise me. And when I was about eight, she met another guy called Dave, and he's now my dad. He adopted me. They get married, and he adopted me when I was 12 years old. And he was in the military, the Royal Engineers, and that sort of paved the way for me joining the army and into the Royal Engineers. And it's what I wanted to do. Do you know, I could stay in Northern Ireland, in Antrim, and not do much, and potentially join a paramilitaries myself, or take a better path, go against the grain, and join the real army. And that's what I chose to do. That sort of led me, 16 applying, 17 joining up to get into it. And it was good. It was this opportunity to go away and start fresh and really I was big into rugby and athletics, and I was really able to push my athletics and rugby career in the military too. My mum was a single parent growing up, as were a lot of the other the kids around. There was a lot of single parents, and she was a big drinker. And I think the later on in life, I learned more and more about my mum, and I can see why she turned to alcohol as that sort of refuge. So it was, but again, back at the time, it wasn't anything different because they all got together, all the mums, they all drank, and the kids just sort of run wild. And again, it was great for me staying out late at night, roaming the streets. Roaming the streets is sort of the... with people also roaming the streets with weapon systems. Like, for example, every Thursday night, we'd just get a knock on the door and it'd be three masked men with automatic weapon systems asking how we were getting on, a bit of a neighbourhood check on steroids. And if something was going wrong, you would say, no, X, Y, and Z is playing the music too loud at that house. Can you go and have a word? And they'd happily go and do it. So there's sort of a good sort of peaceful way and a protection. You felt sort of protected in this bubble. But the relationship with my mum was fine. Again, I was brought up into it, you know. Several nights of the week, they would all get together, my mum and her friends, and have a drink together. And it was just good crack because I would have my friends round.
Who would you say at that time was a main role model for you?
A sort of a role model at that time was probably my two uncles. Because I said there was no father figure in my life at this point. So my uncle Stephen, very big into sport and running, and my uncle Mark, who was like ranked two or something in Northern Ireland or Ireland of tennis, you know, very, very, very good tennis player. I played a lot of tennis myself, and my uncle played as well. So I think because I was very much into the sport and into athletics, my uncle Stephen and my uncle Mark were massive, those sort of role figures. And then I suppose my nana and granddad, you know, I spent a lot of time around at their house. They lived around the corner, literally a stone's throw away. So it was nice to always go there. I think because I got spoiled, you know, I was the eldest grandchild and I just got spoiled.
So knowing that, you know, you're a young lad, it's in a single parent family, talk to me as someone who's not what was that atmosphere like when you speak about masks and balaclavas and automatic weapons on the door? Who were they? And what did you think about them at the time?
I mean, the area I was, so the UDA, also Defence Association, that's who they were. And they're just pretty much a group of individuals doing that sort of protection where, you know, you had obviously the Irish Republican Army, the IRA, around... No, sort of some of the areas. The area I lived in was a very heavily sort of Protestant good area. You know, I liked being brought up there. There wasn't really, I felt safe, you know, and especially when I was in my house, knowing that was happening outside, it kind of made me feel safe. And I mean, even again, I remember one night there was a couple of rounds that went off, shots through the house opposite. It turned out to be a mistaken identity at the time, but no one got killed, thankfully. The bullets very narrowly missed the girl who was in the year below me at school. So she was maybe 6 or 7 years old at this time. And and the guy legged it up the alleyway. And we were all out quickly to see what was happening. And I still felt safe, even though there was a shooting right outside, literally outside my front window. I felt safe. It was the norm. As I mentioned, everyone had just single parents generally. And every time they got together, it was great for the kids to get together.
Were there soldiers on the street?
Yeah, so there were military patrolling the streets in a snatched Land Rover, which I later in my life became very used to. And, you know, we would see them, we would go up and talk to them. You know, hello, mister, what's that there? No, what's this? Can I touch that gun? The typical sort of things kids would do. And also the RUC at the time, rather than the PSNI, as it later changed over to, they patrolled the streets in meat wagons, they were called, which was an armoured vehicle. They get the name meat wagons because They had the nickname Pigs, and obviously Pigs in the back of the vehicle became a meat wagon. So they patrolled the streets daily. And where I lived as well, there was two entrances into the estate. The estate was massive, and there was only two entrances or exits. And during the trouble, or the sort of the marching season, so you sort of June, July, August time, we would always, I got involved a bit helping the older kids. Generally, they'd break into a car, drive it up, park it over the entrance and exit, and set it on fire. And then we were sort of barricaded in. And that happened sort of every year, you know. It was just the thing that was done.
And at what stage of your life at that age did you decide that being in the military was something you wanted to do?
I think, you know, as a kid, we played army goodies v baddies all the time, running around with little sticks and making weapons out of sticks. It was always very interesting to me, you know, running around the bush. I was in the Army Cadets from age 13, and I really enjoyed all that sort of military stuff. And also the thought of potentially, you know, going to war was just quite exciting from quite a young age on. Then when my mum met my dad, and we were down at an events day that the Royal Engineers did in the castle grounds, I was sat inside a digger popping balloons on this sort of open day. And it was then I was like, bang, this is what I want to do. I want to be a plant operator in the Royal Engineers. And that's what my dad was. And he said to me when I first met him, oh, I'm a planty. And I'm like, what, you plant things in the army? But turns out it's obviously big, massive back off equipment that you can drive around in and smash things out of the way and dig big holes. So, so probably from around between 8, 9, 10, I knew I wanted to be in the army, hence joining the Army Cadets at age 13. So I joined the army, signed up in 2002 over in Northern Ireland. It takes a little bit longer with the security clearances for obvious reasons. And day one was the 3rd of March 2003 at Lichfield in basic training.
Talk about who Darren Hardy was at that age.
So when I joined up, that sort of Darren Hardy was still the class clown as I just left school, still probably wanting to be the centre of attention, and a very skinny but very physically fit sort of young 16, 17-year-old guy, you know, as most kids were, you know. Back then, we never sat in a room all day playing computers and stuff. We were out running around. So I was very sort of keen, motivated, wanting to learn and bring sort of my Army cadet experience into real Army experience. Did I miss home? No. I remember when I left to join the army. So my dad and my mum went on to have my brother and sister. And they were only like, I think Hannah, my sister, was maybe one or two when I joined up. So quite a big age gap. And Ben probably was around sort of 14, 15. And I remember them standing in the airport. And my dad said to me, when you give your mum a hug, don't look back, just walk away. And I did, and I think I was a little bit upset, you know. I'd just gone away. I'd been gone away in like summer camps with the cadets, so I'd used to be going away. But I knew this time I was properly going away and probably never returning, which today is the truth. So as soon as I got there, you know, I was on the plane, again, I was quite excited. I remember being dressed in what I thought was cool then and what you should turn up for in day one in basic training, a pair of kickers, jeans and a rugby shirt with a corduroy jacket on. I was quite excited. I was actually more nervous about turning up on the day because I'd spilt hot chocolate all down me in the airplane. I remember I was wearing a white Ulster rugby shirt and I was thinking, oh, I'm going to be known as that dickhead that's turned up on day one with chocolate on down his front. So, I wasn't homesick, never have been homesick. Still today would live anywhere. I don't really, as long as I've got a good roof over my head and a safe family, I'm sort of happy.
And joining the army, what did you think you were going to be doing?
I don't really know. I was quite open for it. I mean, I was just, again, from what I'd known from the cadets and trying to put that into the real army, as they say. I always had aspirations of going really far in the military, and doing all these sort of alley courses and fitness courses in the military, and everything that I wanted to do was just always in that sort of always thinking that the next, so I wasn't really thinking about the here and the now, I was thinking about the next level. But it was a bit of a shock into the system when we still got punched in the face or the tummy for messing up. You know, I got my nose broken basic training for falling asleep in a rifle lesson. But it worked because I've never ever fallen asleep in a lesson again. But that's what it was back then. It was that sort of hard discipline way, and you know, I didn't see anything wrong with it. People laugh and call it character building, but actually it is really good, strong character building.
How long was your basic training?
So basic training was, I think it was either 12 or 14 weeks. I can't remember off the top of my head. I think I've done so many courses in the military that are either 11, 12 or 14 weeks. They all sort of roll into one. So I think basic training might have been 12 or 14 weeks long. And it was good. It was good to sort of, looking back, and it was absolutely mental. It was crazy. It was probably amazing, you know. But we were gated for the full time. We were only allowed outside camp to de-weed the main road or when we went on exercise. But the fun things were the hard things that stick out, like queuing up for breakfast and having 30 seconds to eat your breakfast and running out of the scoff house, putting sausages in your pocket, trying to eat them when you're going to your next lesson, or the physical element and being absolutely thrashed. And the thrashings were the fun piece. The bits where wasn't structured PT, it was because we'd fucked up and we were getting absolutely smashed, blanket punishment as a troop, was what I quite enjoyed in a sort of sadistic type way. It just changed me into a sort of a disciplined young man at that point. So after completing my 6-month plant operator mechanic course, which pretty much enabled me to drive anything, I went to my unit in Germany, a 3-5 engineer regiment, and it was an armoured unit. I was quite excited. We talked about a bit of nerves earlier, and this is where nerves actually kicked in, because during basic training and other training courses, you were all there for the first time together. But this time, I was going into something where it was already established. And I pretty much knew to keep my head down and wait to be told to do something, I suppose. I was a young 17, 18-year-old bloke at this point. And I remember hearing the stories of initiations, or the engineering, as we called it. And so be it. You know, I stayed in my room for a few days. People didn't really speak to me much until I was invited to the squadron bar. And it was quite funny, you know. The bar, where we lived was in an accommodation block, and in the bar was at the very top. And at the very bottom in the basement was the sort of the stores department, etc. And I got invited into the bar, and then I had to, I got told to ring this bell as a welcome to the new member, which actually meant I've got to buy everyone a drink in the bar. I know there was around 70 people in there. So luckily it was 50 cents a can of beer. So it wasn't too bad. And then throughout the night, everyone was being surprisingly nice, you know, and probably a bit of a leading them into a false sense of security, because then I had to then be engineered. And unknown to me at this point, there was a bucket behind the bar, and it was being filled up with drink and other bodily fluids, I suppose. Which became my cocktail towards the end of the night. Normally we drink out of a thing called a monkey, which is a big sort of meter-long piece of metal that's used to hammer in, two-man lift, hammer in pickets into the ground. But that wasn't available for me then. And I had to use a traffic cone, a small traffic cone. So I stripped off naked, stood on top of the table, and donned my lips onto the, made a seal around the traffic cone and raised it up for the bucket to be sort of poured in, and it was absolutely horrendous. You know, every time I was being sick, it was the sick was being topped back up in it. And this is what really made me one of the lads. After that, you know, you just get on and do it, you know, and it's what you want to see. And they'd all gone through it, I went through it, others after me go through it, and then I had to do a thing called roof running, where I would go out onto the roof of this 4-story building in November, freezing cold in Germany, naked, run over the top and down in the other side, which made me one of the lads. Unfortunately, you get locked out of there, and I was out there for quite some time going blue, just sitting at the window waiting to come in, seeing everyone enjoying a drink. And then I came in and I was welcomed into the squadron. That was me. That's when I seen myself be a Royal Engineer. So some time passed, we did adventure training, we did some good stuff, and then it was, right guys, we're being deployed to Iraq, and I was excited. So we do a thing called pre-deployment training, and I got put into, you get put into like bricks and multiples, and I was in a multiple with me and 11 other guys, and that we would like create this bond that we never knew that we still have today. And we worked in that sort of multiple, and it was a 3-stacked Land Rovers, 4 people per one. Each one was known as a brick, and we were a multiple. The OC's multiple, which meant we basically moved in and around Iraq. We did new routes. We did force protection, so we would escort people around there. So we practiced all this in back in Germany, and we did some exercise in Poland. So we practiced in minus 20 to go and operate and fight in plus 50. So typical military. I remember one particular day we were out doing some sort of fire control and PERS maneuvers. So you're going up through the wood block, freezing. It was so cold, I could hardly even change my magazine. And I was thinking, what use is this when we're going out to operate in plus 50? And I mentioned, you know, earlier, John, I spent a lot of time growing up with my Nana and Granda, who played a very big part in my life. And I remember going back into the troop shelter. This was in March, just before deployment in April. And I had all these missed phone calls on my Nokia 3210, I think I had at the time. And I was like, oh, what's going on? I got through to my dad, and he's like, Darren, your nan, mate, she's gone. And I was heartbroken. I was absolutely heartbroken, just about to deploy to Iraq, and sort of this major figure, woman figure in my life was no longer here. And she died of cancer. I sort of knew it was coming, because when I was back home on Christmas leave, I was quite sad leaving, because I sort of knew it was the last time I was going to see her. And I immediately had to get back. In Northern Ireland, there's a bit of a joke. You don't leave the body to go cold before you bury them. And I knew I had to get back for the funeral. And I did. The OC said to me I wasn't able to go because we were ready for deployment. I was like, you don't understand. This is like my mother. I have to go. And because it's not your immediate parents, so your mum or your dad, you're generally not allowed to go. Eventually, he granted me some 2 days leave. So I put that into the weekend. And then I was able to fly back and bury my nan, which was great being there sort of for the family. And then it was back in, straight into normal jogging before deployment to Iraq.
Tell me about the first few days in Iraq.
So it was weird going into Iraq. So you fly from Bryce Norton and on a normal plane into Kuwait. You normally get a Hercules plane, and you go in, and Hercules is a massive sort of transporter of people and equipment. So this middle row of seats can be removed and you can put vehicles in it. And I remember when we were flying in from Kuwait up into Basra, it was pitch black and it was exciting at this point. I had a little iPod at the time. I was trying to listen to some music and sort of relax. And I was sat right up near the cockpit. And the plane fires out this thing called chaff, and it basically it's like fireworks that come out off the side of the plane. And what that means is sort of any heat-seeking missiles are coming up towards the plane, it'll go towards that and not us, because we're at quite a vulnerable point coming into land. And it's the RAF that fly the planes. And then without warning, the plane does this huge like nosedive. It's called an operational landing, and it lands on the runway. And no. The RAF love this. They get a bit of a kick out of the new guys of not being on any sort of operational tour, and then you land. And then you quickly go into a Chinook helicopter, and went from there. We were transported then to where we sort of needed to be. I mean, that was pretty, it sounds epic, but to be honest, you didn't even know you're flying on this thing. It's just sitting on a big bus, really. I remember running on the back of it in the desert heat, and the exhaust blowing onto my face was roasting hot. So we got in, and then you do about 4 days acclimatization, So again, minus 20 to plus 50, 4 days of acclimatization. Some weapon handling skills, and then you get taught about the air, the threat coming in. We used to get mortared every single day. And this was probably the hardest part of Iraq, because you didn't know where the mortars were going to land. The enemy would guess and sort of walk them in. And we claimed, the camp claimed so many casualties with these mortars. And some of them were very, very close. And I remember the first time it happened, the Iraqis knew the transition period of new troops coming in and other ones going out, and knew it's quite a vulnerable point. So that's when they stick in these mortars quite a lot. And I remember my very first time lying underneath my bed, because you're supposed to get under sort of as much possible cover, as much cover as possible. And I was in line with body armor on, helmet on, writing my letter home, oh shit, I'm going to die, basically. Here, mum and dad, sorry that I've fucked up, and just all look after each other and don't worry. And from there, you just sort of then get thrown into your full operational role. And then after 2 weeks in country, the mortar attacks coming in are just a nuance. They're annoying. You don't really pay much attention to it. You literally, if it wakes you up in the night, you put your air defenders back on and roll over and go back to sleep with your combat duvet, as we say. Not that it's going to offer any protection. And that's it, really. We went into numerous missions in and out of the country or all around the country, exploring new territory, escorting people. Probably until this one main operation that we're on. And it lasted for 37 hours. And basically, in May, so we'd only been there 6 weeks, maybe in this helicopter, a British Army helicopter was shot down by the enemy from a surface-to-air missile or an RPG. And it landed in downtown Basra, and we, as the sort of the stood up ready to go, were tasked to go out and recover the helicopter and the bodies within the helicopter. And we moved from Shaiba Log Base into Basra Apod and waited to the cover of darkness to move. And we were escorted by warrior tanks. I think the PWR were in them at the time. And they had already gone in and secured the initial crash site. And we were coming in to go onto it. And they sort of pepper podded, so it's sort of 1 foot in the ground. So they're giving us cover as we're moving in to darkness. And we got there. We tipped up in downtown in Basra, right next to the Shatt Al Arab River. And then they knew we were coming, obviously. There was it attracts a lot of attention, and as I remember getting there and this RPG flying straight over our heads, we're like, well, fucking hell, lads, this is real. Game face is on, let's go. We got up onto the roof. We were approached when we got into the building, said building where the helicopter was on the roof. And we were told, we met with this RMP, so basically a military policeman who get the nickname Monkeys. And jumped up, they get a rank quite early on, they're jumped up, they're power hungry, basically a bit of a job's worth sometimes. And there's not much of a relationship between military and the military police. And he was gobbing off us, so we let him do his thing. We got brought upstairs, and it was still dark at this point. We didn't really know what we were sort of about to encounter. So we just chucked ourselves up against the wall, relax, sort of is quite commonly known in the military. As soon as you get told to sit down for 5 minutes, you just sit down and relax and chill out, because you don't know what's going to come next. And they managed to get these big lights up onto the rooftop, and they got run up through generators, and boof, lights come on, and we're like, fucking hell. We were surrounded by this helicopter, and unknowing the bodies, we couldn't see much in it, and it was our task to start picking them up and find the body parts. And it's the parts of the body, the silly little things. I remember someone saying, find the dog tags, we need to identify these people. And finding I remember my mate Ad's picking up a leg, just with a boot on it, and his dog tag was on his eyelet of his lace. I remember picking a rib cage up, not knowing it was a rib cage. And I think the smell was absolutely disgusting. It just was, talking about it now, and I can sort of the smell of it. And, you know, and again, my mate Ad's really, really good friend of mine, I would call him a brother. Now, we did everything together. It was always us, and whatever happened, it was us. And I remember him saying, "No, can you help me pick up the pilot?" And the sort of the front of the helicopter was over the edge of the building, and he pulled the pilot out with all his might, and, you know, half a body came out, and it just wasn't even a full intact. And I remember looking at Ad's and seeing that sort of shock of desperation. He shut his eyes, shut the pilot's eyes, and no, bit of a minute of silence or a second of silence before getting him in the bag and sort of stacking up these body parts as we found going through, literally finding right down to fingers, you know. And yeah, I mean, it took a long time to cover that up. But I remember sort of working right through the day, and then we were also then helping enforce the PWR on the ground. So we would do a rotation of picking body parts up. Then we'd be in the front line with a shield and a riot baton and sort of defending off the sort of area and just taking a lot of shit from the locals, you know, spitting at us, kicking, etc., the shields. There was other guys up on roof trying to take pictures, and then some of our lot had to go out and chase them off. And there was a sniper that kept always taking pot shots. And it was just a desperation sort of area, you know. It was just like, oh my fucking God, like, what is going on? 37 hours later, you know, we were sat just before we were ready to depart. Someone brought some hot food with us, and we were just sat next to all these body bags, just eating food, not even acknowledging that there was actual people that lost their lives next to us, because it was just a job, really. I was 20 years old. And I think from that point then, it was just like, fuck, shit's just got real, you know? And then we get escorted back to the airport, Basra Airport. And then someone immediately was saying, right, you've got to go through the wreckage. Another mate of mine, Gaz, he'd lifted off the crane, with the crane lifted the main body of the helicopter and put it on the back of a low loader. And we were told to go through it when we got there. And as we were about to, someone else was running out. I think it was like some military police again. No, you can't go through it. It's a crime scene in essence. And that was it. We were like, thank fuck for that, because we did not want to trawl through any more parts of wreckage. And then from there, it was sort of back to normal jogging. I remember the padre having a couple of words with us, you know, if you just want to talk about it, you know, crack on. And then I remember getting back to camp, and the sergeant major was like, right, lads, you've seen some shit, you know, just time to forget and move on. And that was the sort of the way we were brought into the military. It was like, okay, that's what it is. And he's like, you can have tomorrow off, relax, recuperate, and then you can get back to normal jogging. But unfortunately for Ads and I, that wasn't a day off, because we were the youngest sort of sappers there. And it was like, right, guys, you're on guard shift. And yeah, we went straight onto a guard shift for 12 hours, which is basically up in the Sanger Towers, monitoring and scanning for any sort of enemy encroaching on camp, etc. And then back onto normal jogging and see the rest of the tour through. You know, there was plenty of other things that happened. But that was the most significant sort of event there. And that sort of finished up the tour, 6 and a bit months out there in Iraq. Generally, when you come back from operational tour, you do a 2-week decompression somewhere like Cyprus, and it's basically you've just been out in a sort of a country war fighting, trying to be killed, and killing, and then come back to decompress, get rid of that testosterone. You go to Cyprus, you drink a lot of booze, you all fight, and then it's out your system by the time you get back. I didn't have that opportunity. I was, I can't remember the days, but for argument's sake, finishing Iraq on a Friday and then starting my PTI course on a Monday, so back in Germany. So it was very much having to switch from one environment where the threat was high to normal environment. And I probably didn't process anything from Iraq, really. And it was just straight into that. And so I did my physical training instructor course, became an Army PTI, and spent then a lot of my time, the rest of my time, as a soldier, as a physical training instructor, before posting to Northern Ireland. Went there back home in Northern Ireland. I was based in Antrim, where I grew up, before quickly moving to RAF Aldergrove, and a new unit came in. And it was then, you know, it was to sort of show that there's still quite a threat there. We checked our cars every morning for bombs that were placed underneath it, because I lived out of camp. You're always checking over your shoulder, and you're sort of trying to blend in. A bit easier for me because of my accent. But then I think March or May in 2009, Patrick and Mark, two sappers, got cowardly gunned down by the IRA outside camp just before a deployment to Afghanistan for the unit. I knew them. If I was the PTI in camp, saying hello, they were quite into their football and training, but they weren't my unit. But it was sort of that quite close to home, you know, of what can happen. The next day, we fixed up some of the stuff with the gun holes, where the shots were. And then it was at that point, I was like, you know, I'm at this point in my life. Do I go into the physical training corps so you can leave the army and join the physical training corps? Or do I commission? I had a recommendation for commission off a few sort of reports in the past. Actually, when I left phase two training, I was like, have you ever thought about commissioning as well? So it was always there. And I did. I commissioned. I went into Sandhurst and commissioned 2012. So that's a year and a half period. I had to do a pre-course into Sandhurst, which is a year long, which is basically for ex-ranking soldiers. And it was a bit of a cheese and wine course, as they call it, and learned teaching you how to speak properly and eat properly and trying to educate you. And I went through Sandhurst of this, you know, me coming from where I came from to mixing with guys from Eton and various, you know, degree backgrounds. And I had to put on this different me, and I hated it. I just did not like to be there. I didn't want to be there. When I commissioned, I didn't see it as an achievement. Whereas people looking from the outside, you know, commissioning through the world's most prestigious training academy is a big thing, you know. I just seen it as an extra long military course. And then I commissioned, I went into the Med Corps actually at this point, because I wasn't smart enough to go into the engineers to start with. And that was a whole new sort of life and journey at that point. We went out into Canada to this, so you do training exercise called BATIS, British Army Training Unit Suffield, in Alberta. And when we were out there, we were training. You're training for deployment. You know, there's a couple of thousand troops training, and you sort of two enemy. You fight another sort of a unit. So in essence, you've got a battle group here and a battle group here, and you're both tested. And during that time, as an officer, a very young officer at this point, but with a good bit of military experience, I was sitting in a command post, and it was a very hot day. Canada gets so bloody hot. So this is 2015. So fast forwarded a bit from commissioning. And I was there at my troop, doctors, nurses, physios, dentists, combat medical technicians, and everyone there. And I was sat in a command post, 9x9 tent off the back of a Land Rover. And it was at this point where this incident sort of changed me completely. And I heard this Land Rover, it was actually a pickup truck, screaming up out the back of the tent. And all this commotion going on outside, and someone shouting, "Boss, boss, it's real." So we were receiving real life casualties and training casualties. So one, we could be tested, and two, sort of to make sure our skills were up to deployment level. And as I came out of my tent, there was this a soldier being sort of like half carried in to the treatment facility, and she was in shit state. In a nutshell, she had fallen into a fire, and on the live training exercise, live firing stage of the exercise, because it's so hot and dry and it's like hay, the tracer round set the grass on fire. And there's these soldiers out there trained to beat the fire out. And sometimes we would go and cut the ground up to start it from spreading from our tracked vehicles. But unfortunately, she fell into it. And by the time she got to us, as saying she was burnt all over. I mean, she was wearing eye protection, and you could see where her glasses were, which was safe, and everything underneath was sort of burnt very, very badly. Her airways were burnt, her hands were burnt, and I remember this sort of her lying on the bed, and her hands were up in this position. It was literally dripping big white bits of molten flesh. And I was like, right, kick in, what seems to happen? So I started detailing people off into every single job that they needed to do. Accompanying her was another 7 or 8 burnt people, not heavily burnt, but we're trying to help there. So finger burns, stuff in their like legs. So we had to very quickly triage everything off and get all these guys sorted. But she was our number one priority, and we needed to get her out of there. And there was no other way to get her out of there bar air, or she was going to die. So I called a stop over the whole exercise of all this firing, because we were firing, so the artillery would be firing their guns up, and I knew we wouldn't be able to fly any air in if there was still live firing. At this point, I had so many people on the net speaking to me. So 8 Bravo, who runs the exercise, my boss, was being just a nuisance. So he was very quickly binned off, and I had to just focus on this. And then I got comms with a helicopter as they were coming in. And as the helicopter was sort of circling, we were packaging up and trying to get lines into this girl to save her life. And it was proving very difficult because her veins were burnt as well. And I remember one minute she would just come around and talk normally about her dog, her chocolate brown Labrador, and her family. And next minute she'd be drifting into a sort of state of unconsciousness. And it was quite a weird thing to see. And I was legging it between everything, making sure everything was going on as the officer. You know, this was on my watch. If she dies, this is my fault. And I had to cut around and go out to the helicopter place, mark the landing zone for it to come in, which we did. We managed to package her up, get her into the helicopter, and bug her out to Calgary. There's a big burns unit there. And I remember sitting afterwards talking and debriefing the troops, and it came over the net that she was like, she took a turn for the worse in the helicopter. So they had to be redirected to Medicine Hat. From there, they would stabilize her and then would move her up to Calgary. At this point as well, I knew it affected some of the soldiers that work in their brand new out of training. I had to sort of look after their welfare and make sure they're all right. I had to restock on my med supplies and had to make sure we were good to go and start to be ready to treat someone else. And good job it was, in a way, because the 2 days later, one of the instructors, one of the DS, was shot through both legs by accident. And we were there on it again to make sure he was all right. That was a little bit funny, though, because he was in the wrong place at the wrong time. And he was all right in the end. It was after that I sent the troops to bed, and I reflected on the day. And on the day, I sat in the tent smelling the burning flesh. It just lingered for a couple of days, and picking up bits that were missed, and really just thinking, like, I hope she makes it. It's going to be my fault if she doesn't make it. Did I make the right decision here? Did I do that right? And it was all about processing this decision making. And thought about it really, really intensively. I think when you're at war, you expect it, but when you're in training, you don't. So I was really starting to process all in my brain. And I went back to, we finished our exercise 6 weeks out in the field, back to the UK. And I started to change, really, really change as a person. I was a captain at this point. I was an ops officer, which is sort of a senior level captain. I should have been like a moral compass of the unit, never mind just the officers. But I was downtown, I was fighting, I was being indrawn. I started to like discharge myself away from people. I didn't want to like socialize. I just got up in the morning, I went to the gym, I went to work, I went to the gym, I went to bed, and I just repeated that when I was based in Catrick. And I thought just that was normal. That's how I was. And I came sort of back down to the south. I was based in Catrick at the time, back down south. And I was sat at a kid's birthday party, actually. And I was sort of withdrawn in the corner. And someone said to my now wife, what's up with Darren? And she spoke to me afterwards. And that's when I realized, shit, other people are realizing that there's something wrong with me here. And so I went to the doctor, and I was diagnosed with PTSD. And it turned out the smell of the burning flesh sort of triggered the stuff from Iraq, because I kept getting these nightmares about Iraq, about incidents, other incidents, not just the helicopter, other incidents that happened. And it was really weird. They would start mixing fact and fiction. And even now, I can just recall the other night, having these dreams of mates who are no longer with us, unfortunately, crawling in through my door, blood all over them, asking for my help, and me being too scared to get out of bed. And that's how in depth these dreams are going. And it's hard. I just now have to sort of manage it. Yeah, so 2015, I'd come back from Canada, had this diagnosis of PTSD. Didn't really know what it was, didn't know how to receive it. And I thought to myself, God, I need to focus on something in the military. So I signed up to become Special Forces, so a Special Forces communicator, and that's what I wanted to do, be part of the the UKSF group. I trained for it, I went on it, and I came off it, unfortunately. And I came off it because it started in January. I was doing all right, I was doing well, but something bad hit me on it. And I'll just rewind back to December. So sort of October-y time, October-ish, I was diagnosed with PTSD. And then I was getting married in December. 21st of December, we were like getting married, and we were all excited for it. During, you do different types of training to be special, BSF, I suppose. You do like a briefing course, then a prep course. And then I was released from my unit to go down to pull and sort of work with the lads down there at the SFC wing, and really get into it and learn more about the role in the trade. And it was coming up to Christmas leave, and I was excited. I was getting married, and my now wife Gem and I, we were in London, sort of enjoying that sort of week off before we get into Christmas leave. It was a weekend, and we were coming out of London, and it was sort of, I remember this day. You know, I was on this busy train, and I was like, my dad kept ringing me. And I thought, oh, he's excited about me going on. He's tell me about the wedding. Is he going to tell me about? He was excited for me to go on a course. And it was the conversation went, Darren, it's your mum. And I was like, she's gone. I was like, what do you mean she's gone? She's like, she's dead, son. Your mum's dead. And I was like, and I think on a train in Waterloo, full of people, was maybe a bit of a savior. I just had to process it and tell Gemma that my mum was dead. And she was 51 years old. And I mentioned earlier, you know, she was big into drinking, and I think that just carried on through. And unfortunately, that drinking for so many years and everything else just takes its toll, and she fell over and hit her head and died, apparently, in her own house in the living room or in the hallway. And it was my uncle who had the grand finer. So that was a bit of a shit card to be dealt with 2 weeks before getting married. I think what's made it even harder, I remember driving home from pool one weekend, having a conversation with my mum and a bit of an argument with my mum and uninviting her to my wedding because I didn't want to have the embarrassment of someone being drunk and having to look after her at the wedding. So that was a pretty hard thing to sort of swallow, pretty hard pill to swallow. And, you know, it's life, you know, you have to sort of get on with it. And I flew home and went to, obviously, my mum and dad had split up at this point because of her drinking problems. And I was next of kin, and, you know, I had to sort of bury my mum and, you know, buy a coffin and arrange the funeral. And I was like, what is this all about? Whilst organising that, I had to still help my wife and help trying to organise the wedding. So we buried my mum, and then 2 weeks later, we got married. And one of the saddest things, I think, on that, when I went home and we were clearing up around my mum's house, it was... we found the wedding, or the dress that she'd bought for the wedding. So we thought it was only right that we bury her in that. And that's what we did. But it was really hard. I mean, even now, you know, sometimes when life gets a little bit tough, I've got a little memory drawer of her, and I go and, you know, I've got her last shopping list that she wrote on the 4th of December, and she died that evening. So I just had to sort of pick everything up, and I was starting selection at the Hills phase in 2 weeks after that, or a week and a half after that. So I had to get amongst it and get on and regroup. So it was a bit of a roller coaster of emotions, I suppose. And that's what brought me off the Hills phase when I was on my own. I had a lot of time to think, and it really, really affected me. So that carried on. 2016, I went through this sort of military, the army discharge period. I was discharged in 17, just 6 months after my daughter was born as well. So everything was a bit weird in life. I was moving house, being discharged from a job that I loved, and didn't really know what to do, starting a new job. And I just had to move on with it. And also that this word PTSD really, really kicked in and really, really hit me hard. And 17, I struggled. I didn't speak to anyone. I struggled. And I probably urge anyone now that is thinking of anything that may be floating around in the head, you've got to speak to someone. You know, I tried to be the stiff upper lip military approach and it didn't work. It drove me to wanting to pull the pin on my life. And I was sat in Tesco's car park crying on the phone to my uncle. With flights almost ready booked to go out to the Middle East and fight as a mercenary. I love war, and I wanted to go out and end my life that way. And I thought about my daughter, Georgia, and also Jessica was just about to be born, so my wife was pregnant again. And I thought about them, and I said I grew up without a father, and I didn't want that for them, and instantly changed overnight, literally changed my life overnight. I thought, get a fucking grip of yourself, Darren. You've got a family to look out for. And that's what I did. And from then, I set this new me. I get up at 0420. I train because that's where I love it. And I release all the good endorphins in my body and do physical exercise because I believe that is a cure for many, many things. And really get out and attack the day and set all these like events and focus points and stuff to look forward to and goals and world records, you know, and I've done plenty, you know, gone out to Colorado to run for Team UK, double gold medalist, record breaker in the 1 and 200 meters, and then get into like, you know, out to the Yukon to the world's toughest race, to win my last one, 5 marathons and 50 hours. And I try really, really focus the point on doing it for a cause and doing it for something. And of late, I'm really, really focusing on raising £1 million for this young girl, Aggie, who I came across. Her father is writing my book to be out next year. And it's everything I do now is my focus point for raising that money to save Aggie's life. She's one of 3 children in the UK diagnosed with the world's rarest brain disease. And I've seen my own kids, my own kids in her when she was younger. And I've watched it deteriorate, you know, when she's 12 years old now and deteriorate. And I'm now going to do everything in my power and pick these crazy events and challenges that people think that can't be done. And I'm going to raise the profile and really set that and raise the money. And I'm going to help save her life as long with others and sort of be the sort of trailblazer in making that happen for other kids around the world.